The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
LinkedIn presents.
I'm Maura Ahrens-Mealy, and this is The Anxious Achiever, the show that looks at the intersection of mental health and work and how we can all do both better. We've been having a conversation for some years now about women's mental health and how it evolves and gets stressed when they become parents, how women are always struggling, and I speak from experience, between the desire for a big career and the desire to be with our kids. It can create what's called role conflict. I will never dismiss the mental health of mothers. But today, we're going to focus in on fathers, who, while criticized for not always sharing the mental load or, you know, being kind of not with it, are sometimes forgotten in these conversations. In the past 10 years, even, we've seen a huge shift around the expectations that dads face at home and what society lets them feel safe in expressing they want from being dads. Men are now facing many of the challenges that women have in decades past. So here to talk with me are Brad Harrington and Liam Martin. Brad is a Boston College professor and a longtime researcher of career management, work-life integration, and dads. He wrote the 2011 book, The New Dad, Caring, Committed, and Conflicted. Liam Martin was a local TV anchor in Boston for WBZ, which is the CBS affiliate here. But he recently left his job, in part, to better prioritize his own mental health and the well-being of his family. I speak to them about changing expectations, the conflicts men still feel, and why it really matters for mental health and for the workplace. I wanted to start big picture with both of you and get your thoughts about how you've seen, you're both media savvy, you follow these storylines and public narratives, and at work, how's fatherhood changed in the past few years, maybe even since the pandemic, and even the notion of working fatherhood? What are the big trends that you're both seeing? Brad, let's start with you.
So, I mean, one of the changes you've seen is sort of society's acceptance of fathers as being more than breadwinners. And I mean, I think it's the case that they always were more than breadwinners, but there was a sense that, you know, father's role in the family was a fairly detached one. And that, you know, the old stereotypes about, you know, dad brings home the paycheck and wait till your father gets home and all this stuff, I think was dispelled pretty early on, even in 2011, when we did our initial large quantitative study. And we realized that those two factors were very small compared to, you know, father saying a good dad is somebody who's present, who's engaged, who's a good coach and mentor who provides support. So back even in 2011, we started to see those stereotypes change. But just a couple of years later, we were asked by a big consumer goods organization to just kind of give them a view of how fatherhood is perceived based on research that we had done. And one of the areas we went into was how fathers portrayed in the media and in advertisements and stuff like that. And even though the concept of fatherhood was starting to change, I think generally what you saw in that was these characterizations of fathers that were really disparaging. It talked as, you know, dad as incompetent, dad as Neanderthal. You know, the famous case was when Huggies, and I hate to pull out a brand name, but when they said, we put our diapers to the ultimate test. We left the kids home with fathers alone and to see over a weekend to see whether or not fathers, you know, almost like the assumption is fathers are going to sit there and wait till their wife gets home in order to change the diapers. It was very dismissive. And one of my colleagues used to say, if we talked about women in the workplace the way we talk about fathers in the home, we'd be sued or we'd be dinosaurs or what we were saying would be outrageous. And yet it seemed to be permissible even a decade ago to kind of characterize fathers that way.
Yeah.
And what we've seen over the last 10 years is more and more acceptance of fathers in that broader role. We see advertisements that now show fathers in a much more positive light, you know, oftentimes playing with their children, nurturing their children, that kind of thing, as opposed to taking their kid to McDonald's and playing football with them as if that's the be-all and end-all. That's really what I've seen, is that sort of continuous sort of evolution of fathers. I don't think we've had the dramatic change of statements that the women's movement had. I don't think we have the leaders that the women's movement had, but I have definitely seen progress over time. And I think organizations, particularly, which is what we study, are really starting to very much catch up with the view that, you know, dads are very much engaged parents, want to be, need to be, and that's the way we're going to have to start viewing them in the future.
Liam, what do you think?
Yeah, it's interesting. Brad comes at this obviously from much more of a research background. And I think it's true that the notions around fatherhood are changing, thankfully. There's still some catching up to do. So, you know, when I grew up, kind of the message you got growing up, and I think society still carries this to some extent, is that the dad should still provide. That is his primary job, is to make enough money to take care of the family. And at the same time, increasingly dads are under pressure to be more engaged and involved mm-hmm. at home and as dads and as a partner in household duties and all of that. And what it's done is led to these competing pressures on dads. And moms have tons of competing pressures of their own too, maybe even more. But the primary competing pressure for dads is, on the one hand, society, and survey after survey shows this is still the case, expects you to provide. And also, you need to be an equal at home. And men are torn. They are not sure where to put their priorities. And it can lead to this sense that they're not doing a very good job in either of those roles.
A lot of role conflict.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, I have felt it. I have seen it with my guy friends. I had a job in television news for 15 years that was very demanding. And at the same time, I had made a decision that I wanted to be a really involved dad and husband and try to split things 50-50 as much as possible. Brad talks a lot about the difference between the egalitarian father and the conflicted father. And, you know, the egalitarian father is one who believes that the household duties should be split evenly and is able to achieve that. The conflicted father is the one who believes that should be the case and yet can't make it happen. And often, as a result of that, feels a little bit like failure in both aspects of their lives, where they can't quite climb in their careers the way they want to because they want to get home and they want to be involved. And, you know, maybe they're a little bit more likely to take time off, that kind of thing. And yet they still don't feel like they're achieving at home in the way that society expects them to and that they want to.
Yeah. It's so funny. I spoke yesterday with a young man who works at a huge tech company, really high-powered guy who just had his first baby. So he's been on parental leave. He's heading back. And he's like, you know, I thought that this priority shift would happen and I would just have this, you know, it's almost this clearing moment where it's like, my priorities in life are different now that I have a child and I'm here for my child. He's like, but I still can't sleep because of work and I have a new boss and I'm so worried about what's going to happen at work. And it's really upsetting me because I feel guilty because that's not where my priority should be. You know, he almost sounded like a mom. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a dilemma that women have dealt with for a very long time, or as you well know, both personally or in terms of the work you do. But, you know, for fathers, it is relatively new that there is that expectation. And it's not like, you know, now that the fathers have decided that there are these conflicting roles that you described, that all of a sudden we should all sit up and say, oh, the poor dad. But what we do need to understand is that this is, to some degree, a conflict that has really been exacerbated, as Liam said, in recent years, you know, where fathers suddenly see societal expectations being both about being a breadwinner and the career-focused person, as well as being, you know, a really engaged caretaker as well.
I am not about to sort of tell you how to feel as dads, because I actually have a lot of sympathy and empathy for men in this society right now. I think it's really, really hard.
You know, the thing that's interesting, Brad and I have talked about this, is that women have dealt with these competing pressures for a long time, you know, since they started entering the workforce. And at first they were told they shouldn't be doing that. And there is still some of that in certain pockets of our society. But what women did was kind of created a tribe around it. I'm sure, Maura, that you have friends and you discuss these things and you, you talk about your feelings, and it gives you this outlet and this sense that you're not alone in it. And men don't really do that. It's not in our nature to call up our buddy and talk for an hour about what's going on in our lives. And it's funny, I'll take yearly trip with my buddies down to Cape Cod to fix up our old house down there. And every time I get back, my wife will ask, so what's going on in Pete's life? What's going on in Jay's life? And I have no idea what is going on in any of their lives. We make fun of each other for 2 days and play some video games and eat some good food. And that's about it. And so we've got these competing pressures, and yet we haven't found a way yet. And it's changing slowly, but we haven't really found a way yet to discuss it and feel okay saying, I'm not really doing well with this right now. I'm struggling with this or that. We haven't found a tribe in the same way that women have.
Not only do men not do this personally, organizations, which, is what we study at the center, don't really have some kind of vehicle by which men could begin to engage in this conversation. They have so-called employee resource groups or affinity groups, and they have them for persons of color, for persons with disabilities, for veterans, for moms, and so forth. But the thought of having a group for dads to get together and talk about their common issues and their common struggles just doesn't seem to dawn on most organizations. It's as if, if you're a dad, then this is not a challenge for you, balancing work and family. So in addition to the informal conversations that Liam was talking about, they're really, even in large organizations like the one I'm most familiar with, very few have opportunities for dads to have a conversation as well, where they can get together and share, their common struggles and good ideas.
So listeners, go out and start your dad's father's business resource or ERG group. So Liam, you left your high-powered career recently as a TV news reporter to address your mental health, to try to find some balance.
Yeah, I was a television journalist, as I said, for 15 years and had worked really hard to get to where I wanted to be in that business. I became the morning anchor at the CBS station in Boston, which was that was my dream job. It's where I wanted to get, and I worked very hard to get there. And about a year into that role, I was in a pretty bad mental health state. I got the role 3.5-4 years ago, and a year and a half in is when I started to realize I was really struggling. So I've dealt with obsessive compulsive disorder my whole life and depression, but had found it mostly manageable. I had had, a couple of episodes throughout the course of my life, but was, largely in a good place with it. And I went to this schedule. I was up at 2 o'clock in the morning, 5 days a week, and in bed at 7:30, 8 o'clock if I was lucky, and, raising two kids while doing that schedule. And, the job is stressful too. There are ratings and expectations and all this stuff. And about a year in, I realized I was not in a good place. And I had kept it a secret from my wife, from my closest friends, to some extent from myself even, just not willing to reckon with the situation I was in and what it meant for my future. But a year in, it got bad enough that I recognized I needed to make a change and that I was not going to be able to continue working those hours. I think, there are some people who can do it for whatever reason. Their biology is a little different and they can wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning and do it for 30, 40 years and be fine. I was not one of those people. And I had to be honest with myself about that. As hard as I had worked to get to where I was, I had to let it go. And there was an opportunity to move back to the evening show, but if I did that, I would miss my kids growing up. The evening anchors are in at 2:30, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, so they see their kids off to school, basically, and that's it.
Yeah.
And so I just made the decision that if I want to live a life aligned with my priorities, which is to be a good dad and husband and to take care of my mental health, then I had to make a change.
Did you feel anxious doing that?
Extremely. For a variety of reasons. There was, I didn't really know any other career. I had done it for 15 years. What else could I really do? And then there were just the financial considerations. We've talked about the expectation in a lot of society that dads will take care of the family. And I had definitely created a situation in my family where that was the case. I was the breadwinner. And so I couldn't just jump to something else and, you know, take a huge pay cut. It wouldn't have worked out for us financially. And I felt a little bit trapped by that. But I spent the next year continuing to do my job on TV and trying to find an exit plan. And I applied to all kinds of things and eventually struck gold with this idea to start a company and just use the skills I had created as a journalist to, you know, build something else, build something for myself, which gave me, you know, the ultimate flexibility. And I worked from home. So it was a long process with a lot of anxiety to get me to this point, but I'm glad I took the path I did.
How do you anchor the news when you're depressed? When I'm depressed, my face hurts and it's so heavy, I can barely talk.
Yeah, that's interesting. Especially the morning show, you are supposed to be chipper.
Yes.
And high energy, and getting people started for their day and cracking jokes and stuff. I've always been very good at hiding it. And I don't know that that's a talent. I'm not proud of that, but I hid it even from my wife, who is a psychologist, for years that I was in this state. And, you know, in retrospect, she said, I knew something was up. I just didn't know the extent of it. But I found a way to just compartmentalize. I would show up to work and get on the desk. The lights would go on and I would do my job for the next 2.5 hours. And then it was almost like the air coming out of a balloon after the lights would go off. You know, I would just slump and go back to my desk and go back into that state and then try to get back up again in 30 minutes to do it again. So I don't think that was healthy either.
No, that doesn't sound great.
It's funny. We always talk, you know, in the corporate world about being your authentic self at work and, you know, how important it is to be authentic and, you know, not to put on a facade. But I'm guessing in your industry, Liam, it would have been, please don't be authentic. be happy. You know? And I got to say, as somebody who happened to watch Liam for years on the morning show with his partner, Kate, they just presented this incredibly positive, upbeat, you know, kind of jokey. It was just a very kind of, you know, watching it in the morning was the best thing about the news was the fact that these two were so up, because my wife was always saying to me, stop watching the news.
So depressing. But that's right. Brad, from your research, from your knowledge for decades, how many dads feel trapped like Liam did? Trapped with the expectations of financial responsibility and what they've worked so hard. I mean, Liam, you went to Harvard. I know you graduated top of your class at Northwestern Journalism School. Like, the weight of the expectation can feel like a trap.
I don't know how many fathers actually feel trapped. I can tell you that these conflicted fathers that Liam did a great job of describing earlier, you know, those conflicted fathers, one of the things we looked at is these are the guys who really want to be both, and they're kind of stuck, you know, between a rock and a hard spot, trying to figure out how to resolve this dissonance, you know, that they feel. Reported, you know, really lower levels of life satisfaction, work satisfaction, career satisfaction. You know, by and large, when you compare them to the other two groups that we researched, the egalitarian dads, and then the more traditional fathers. And those were the guys who had, you know, wives who either stayed at home or certainly their career took a back seat. Mm-hmm. And these men, for the most part, by far the primary breadwinners within their family. But these conflicted dads, when you looked at the life fulfillment, life satisfaction, career enjoyment, all those kinds of things, they were the guys who scored the lowest on all those criteria.
The conflicted dads or the traditional dads?
No, the conflicted dads.
The conflicted dads, yeah.
Yeah. The traditional dads, you know, for better or worse, I mean, and we hope that their wife agreed with them, the traditional dads had pretty much said, look, my priority is my career, you know, and that's my way of contributing and being a good family member. And if their wives were in sync with them, which we don't know that they were, they weren't, but I assume that that was at least a conversation these guys had had. You know, there's a lot of families who say we feel a traditional arrangement of some sort is really what's best because it allows one of us to really pay almost 100% attention to the family, which is very important. So those guys, you know, they were in their workspace and, you know, and they were doing well financially and they were doing well in terms of career advancement. The egalitarian dads were making less money. They were much more engaged at home. And the irony is, in fact, in spite of the fact that they were spending more time doing things at home, they were the ones who said work-life balance was the easiest for them. These guys who were conflicted, which were the guys who were stuck in the middle there, as I said, they just seemed to be struggling with a lot of stress, They dealt with a lot of messages from the organization that told them they weren't quite doing what they should be doing. And it really had a corrosive effect, I think. I don't know. We didn't ask questions specifically about mental health, but we did ask a lot of questions about, you know, their satisfaction and fulfillment, as I mentioned. And that was the lowest for those folks.
I want to ask you, too, about identity, you know, and I don't know if you measured, Brad, how their own sort of identity conflict, their sort of leader identity conflicted with the sort of feeling that they also needed to be this perfect dad identity.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, we did ask about identity, and one of the things that was interesting is how many of them said their identity derived more from home and family than from their career. People, when they really reflect on what gives them a sense of fulfillment, a sense of identity in their life and so forth, it tends to come more from their home life than it does from their, you know, from their work life. I mean, I can't say that's true for workaholics who may, you know, are people that are really gung-ho about their careers. But I do think, you know, over the long term, all the research tells you that ultimately, where is your life's meaning going to come from? Where is satisfaction? Where is happiness derived from? It's always about long-term meaningful relationships, personal relationships, and I guess work relationships as well. But as far as you want to derive their sense of identity, I've got to believe that people who are egalitarian probably lean much more in terms of saying my identity comes from family. People who are in the more traditional mode, obviously a lot of their identity is tied up in their work. And one of the things years ago, Stu Friedman, who I know you know more, he and Sharon LaBelle, she was a professor at Seattle University, and she and Stu wrote an article called The Happy Workaholics. And I don't know if you remember this article. It was quite a few years ago.
It's like my motto.
And what they were saying is, you know, when you look at the organizational leaders and the people who are really gung-ho about their career and had advanced in higher levels, we want them to be role models and embody work-life balance, and they're not going to do that, probably. We, you know, kind of foist on them this perception that, oh, if you're working too many hours, if you're working 80 hours a week, you're obviously miserable. That's the answer. And what Sharon LaBelle and Stu said was, when you look at these people and their sense of identity, the real go-getters, the real, you know, senior executives and companies, their identity does come from their work. And so while their life may be out of balance from an objective perspective, if there is such a thing, subjectively, they're happy with their life. And that's what really matters at the end of the day. You know, you could look at somebody and say, gee, he can't be a very good dad if he's working 75 hours a week, but that's my perception. Somebody else who is working 75 hours a week and, you know, has set up a nice lifestyle for their family and is able to afford the better things in life may say, I'm doing exactly what I want to be doing and I am being the best dad I can be. We got to allow people subjectively to really determine what's the answer for them.
That's right. Their work-life fit, like Cali Yost calls it.
Correct. To use a Cali Williams Yost, yes.
Liam, this is probably an ongoing process because it's also new for you. How is your identity? Is it shifting? Is it solid? Are you wrestling? Is it?
Wrestling, I think I would say. I think, you know, I definitely lean toward my role as a dad. But, you know, now I've been starting a business and that requires a lot of time. The great thing about it is the flexibility of it. So the kids get off the bus at a little bit past 3 o'clock, and for at least an hour, I can put everything down. There are some days when I really can't, but for the most part, 90% of the time, I can put everything down for an hour or two and take them to their after-school stuff, play with them a bit, get dinner ready, and then I'll go back to work after that. And so that kind of tells me that I'm choosing that as the priority, is to put the work down. I mean, if I just worked through that time and all the way through them going to bed, continue to work afterwards, I probably would make more money. We'd be able to gain more clients and the clients would be happier and all that. But I don't think I would. So yeah, I think it's, I put myself in that conflicted dad category that Brad has outlined. And I think, you know, a lot of dads feel that way. A lot of my friends are that way for sure.
Yeah, I mean, people assume more that because I do all this research and pontificate about how to be a good dad, that I'm some expert in this. But I was, you know, my story is not that different. So, I mean, I worked in a corporate role for 20 years after I got my graduate degree. I worked for Hewlett Packard. And, you know, initially I was pretty much in local operations. And then the more senior I got, I involved in, you know, more national issues and then international. And pretty soon I was working globally. And, you know, when my kids were very young, They were 4 and 2, and my wife was expecting. I was working 3,000 miles from home and commuting every other week.
Wow.
It was the same kind of a thing for me. But like Liam, I have to admit, I was a conflicted father. A lot of my identity was tied up in my role, my corporate role, and what I was doing. And it took sort of like finally like a moment like Liam described in his article, where I said to myself, you know, this just isn't working. And what's paying the price is my time with my family. Like Liam, I also had a very good paying job at HP and took a very, very big pay cut, very big, 75%. How does that sound?
Whoa. Yeah. And was your wife working at the time or was she home?
No, she was home with the kids.
That's scary.
Totally. You know, most people say, gee, I'd like to change careers, but, you know, I couldn't afford the 5% pay cut. I just shake my head and go, you want to know what it feels like to take that kind of a pay cut? And we had 2 young kids and a third was on the way. And fortunately, I had kind of stockpiled money when I was making a lot and kind of said, we're going to try to see if we can make it through this. But it was, you know, it wasn't easy. And there are times that my wife would look at me and she's the most supportive person in the world, but she'd look at me and go, I'm sorry, what was so wrong with that corporate job? You know, what was wrong with the stock options, the company car, you know, and all this stuff? You know, it just was kind of like one of those things that we both really had to adjust to. And fortunately, because we had, you know, saved well, she was able to then, when the third baby came, stay home for almost 10 years. But it wasn't easy. It was a stretch. And then she went back to work and was very, very successful in a career at Tufts University. Wow. So at the end, she was making about the same as I was, which was great. Like Liam, I mean, I did feel the pressure to be a breadwinner. And the second thing was, I was just caught up in this dilemma of, I'm going from a corporate role where I feel like I'm very credible and very well respected into this academic world where it was, you know, it was a mystery to me. And I certainly was going to be a kind of a low man on the totem pole, relatively speaking.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. In the last 100 years, we've seen financial markets swing, new currencies come and go, decades of savings lost in days. All showing that a retirement plan without a guarantee, quite simply, isn't enough. So more than a retirement plan, TIAA makes you a retirement promise. A promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. A promise that pays off. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
Hi, this is Alex Kantrowitz. I'm the host of Big Technology Podcast, a longtime reporter and an on-air contributor to CNBC. And if you're like me, you're trying to figure out how artificial intelligence is changing the business world and our lives. So each week on Big Technology, I bring on key actors from companies building AI tech and outsiders trying to influence it, asking where this is all going. They come from places like NVIDIA, Microsoft, Amazon, and plenty more. So if you want to be smart with your wallet, your career choices, in meetings with your colleagues, and at dinner parties, tune into Big Technology Podcast on your app of choice.
I want to shift here as we sort of round out to how we live with the conflict and thrive in the conflict. I personally don't see a world in our current always on very black and white binary shareholder capitalism driven world of work where we're not going to feel conflict if we have people we love in our life. I don't know anyone who doesn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, Liam, you're reinventing yourself. You're starting a business. That's what I did. I left corporate, did my own thing. How do we find ways to make the conflict manageable and even work for us?
Huh. Wow. I will let you know when I figure that out. You know, you take it day by day. It's kind of like challenges with mental health. I call it riding the wave. You know, it's blocking out time for the things that really matter to you. It's trying to find somewhat of a routine and not being a slave to a routine, but finding a routine that allows you at the end of the day to say, okay, I think I did a pretty good job. And I think that's a fair standard, pretty good job on all the things that are important to me, my work, my family, my role as a husband, my role as a dad. If at the end of the day, you can say, I think I came pretty close, good enough for government work, then, you know, try to follow that map each day. And I use breathing exercises, honestly, to make myself feel a little bit more present in the moment. And, you know, I'll take a step aside and go, work is going like this and the kids are over here. And I'll just, you know, take a step aside into the bedroom or whatever and do some breathing exercises and come back out and try again. Yeah, it's finding the strategies that work for you. And I'm a perfectionist. And I think that's part of the theme of this podcast.
Yes.
And it's trying to let go of some of that too. You're never going to get it exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think from my perspective, like one of the things you got to do, and I taught courses at Boston College for years on the subject of aligning your values, your interests and so forth with your actions. You know, if you spend a lot of time saying, oh, these are the things I believe, but then you look at your calendar and say, that doesn't look like what you believe in is really where you're spending your time and energy. There are ways you can go through exercises or just reflection. Ask yourself the question, am I really living out my values or aren't I? And it's amazing, having been a corporate guy, it's very seductive. You know, you're traveling to nice places, you're doing, you know, good gigs, you're making all this money, you've got stock options, people are patting you on the head. And there's a point at which it's like, gee, if I was just looking at the externalities, there's nothing wrong with this picture. However, like when I was doing that, I said, but when I look at my own values, how I feel, you know, I feel unhappy. I feel stressed out. I feel like I'm not where I should be at this point in time. Then you've got to kind of say, well, how do I bring these two things, you know, into closer alignment, the values and the actions? I'm not saying that's easy to do at all, but it's important to do. The other thing is, you know, if you have a partner or a spouse, it's so important to say, two things, really. How am I doing for them, or how are we doing together as a couple? That's huge, because part of conflict oftentimes comes from a feeling that I'm not doing, you know, I'm not holding up my part of the bargain here. So part of it is really being able to say, am I doing okay for you? And how do you think we're doing as a couple in terms of bringing this stuff together? And the other thing is, and my wife was great at this, was her giving me feedback about what she was observing. For a lot of years, just going back one more time to my HP experience at the end where I was traveling, I was stressed out, I wasn't sleeping, blah, blah, blah. My wife was always saying, how do I pick up the ball? How do I cover for you? How do I, you know, because half of the time I literally wasn't in within 3,000 miles of her half the time. And I remember at a certain point, everything sort of came to a head. And my wife, who was always supportive, never negative, said to me, it's time for you to look for a new job. And she said it very calmly, but it's the first time she had ever kind of said, you need to fix this and you really need to get yourself in a much better situation because it's not working for you and it's not working for the family. So if you've got that kind of relationship, which I hope people have with a spouse or a partner, really give them an invitation to say, A, how's it working for us? And B, how do you think I'm doing? Like, give me some honest feedback. I'm sure Liam had mentioned in his piece that at one point, you know, he said to his wife he was reluctant to seek help because it would make him look weak. And his wife, who sounds like a great partner, said there's nothing, you know, weak about it. And in fact, the strongest people are people who know when it's time to ask for help. And I think when you've got a partner like that, that I think if I'm not misstating Liam, that really was a turning point for you in terms of saying, you know, she's really putting her finger on the issue. And the same was true for me when my wife said, it's time for you to get a new job. It was the same kind of wake up moment where it was like, I've been carrying on this way too long. And somebody who loves me and who sees me every single day is probably in a much better position to just be blunt with me and tell me what I may not want to hear, but I really need to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a turning point for me because I had held it and kept it a secret for so long, partly because I was unsure of the reaction I would have from her, which in retrospect, I should have known. Of course, she would have been supportive, but that was all my own stuff.
Yep.
And then to see that she reacted in the way she did, it allowed me to then say, you know what, maybe other people in my life will react this way too, and I should trust that will be okay and that it's okay to be vulnerable in this moment.
Yeah.
I think vulnerability is such a underrated force. You know, think of all the people in your life who you've met and within the first few hours you go, I kind of like this person. I connect with this person. It's often because they're not putting on a front and they are vulnerable in some way. It doesn't mean they have to be an oversharer or whatever, but people who are willing to just kind of show themselves and show their cards. There's something powerful about that.
I will say for me, one of the things that my husband and I have really struggled with, and I talk about this a lot on the show, is that my own triggers around money and insecurity. So I think for us as a couple, because we both have had periods in our careers where one of us has been the breadwinner and the other one has stepped back and vice versa, we're very 50-50 in that way. I get triggered because I get worried we're going to run out of money and we're going to lose everything. And I get into this very scary sort of catastrophic place when he asserts his needs sometimes or things are, you know, we shift. And I think that that's something we really don't talk about, is that sometimes your spouse isn't supportive. Mm. Sometimes their own issues step in. Mm-hmm. And to me, like the real work in my partnership has been, I'm actually feeling really triggered right now because of my money stuff. But if this is right for you, I'm going to try to make this work, even though I don't feel like making it work.
Well, and that's the key of the open communication, is the willingness to trust each other well enough that you can get through it, even if there is some sort of conflict there. It's interesting because one of the worries I had, among the many worries, with telling my wife about my situation was that I worried I would become a burden. And I think this is very common with men, that we don't want to open up because we worry, you know, I'm supposed to be the strong one. I don't want to be the one that needs something. And I said to her at some point, you know, I really just don't want to be a burden. So I'm not telling you any of this because of that. And she had this pretty honest reaction, which was, I mean, you kind of, in these moments when you're behaving in this way, you do become a burden. And the only way you won't be is if you get help and if you tell me what's going on.
Right.
It's a self-fulfilling prophecy in a weird way. You don't want to be a burden, so you're keeping it all inside and you're not expressing it or seeking help for it. And then as a result of that, you do kind of become burdensome because you can't behave in the way that I know you should and can. So in the moment, it hurt a lot, but it was true. And I had to, you know, lick my wounds for a bit, but was able to eventually go, yeah, I guess that I kind of am becoming the thing I fear by virtue of not doing what needs to be done.
Yeah. I have a similar thought in terms of my wife at times when I would say to her when I was struggling, you know, what can I do for you? And she'd say, take better care of yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, like if you're your best self, then we're good. But if you're constantly overwrought or unable to sleep or all the things that I was feeling in my last, you know, few years at HP, she said, you know, if you take better care of yourself, then you're going to be just what I need. She continues to say that, by the way.
I want to thank you both so much. But Liam, I want you to tell the audience about your new business. I'm giving you a free plug here.
Oh my gosh.
And share what you want and take us out.
Great. So we founded Newsmaker Marketing, and you can learn more at newsmakermarketing.com. It's a public relations agency by name, but really we do things very differently from a traditional public relations company. We help you get news placements in the way PR typically does, and we can do that really well because we're all from the news field. And so we, you know all of the players in the Boston news scene and really regionally. But we also do social media marketing, video storytelling, using our skills as journalists, and advertising. And so we kind of take every communications aspect that a business has, we can handle that for them and do it in a way that most other PR agencies don't do.
Awesome.
I didn't know I was going to get to pitch it, but there it is.
That's it for this episode of The Anxious Achiever. The show is produced and edited by Mary Dew, with production support and sound engineering by Nick Krinko. If you like what you heard, head to your favorite podcast app. Leave us a review. It really matters, and we appreciate the time and effort it takes. And if you don't subscribe or follow the show already, now's the time. And let us know what you'd like to hear more of. I get some of my best ideas from my listeners, so find me on LinkedIn, send me a message. You could find my weekly newsletter there as well. A big thanks to LinkedIn and all the listeners out there and our guests in the anxious achiever world. Until next time.